with John Shannon. Notice I'm giving you top billing today.
Yeah, why is that?
I don't know. Because I was looking over at your side of the screen, and there you were. And so I, your name just flowed out.
Oh, that's nice of you, Bob.
I'm John's subservient sidekick, Bob McCowan. We're
going to
talk,
man.
We probably don't spend enough time talking about the National Football League.
No, we don't. We don't.
I don't know exactly why.
And I do love the NFL. I really do love the NFL. I love watching it.
You know me.
It's so entertaining.
I'm not so much an NFL fan. I'm a Cleveland Browns fan. And I think most people adopt a team and that's their level of interest. I am really hyper like that. I'll watch very few, not none, but very few NFL games where the Browns aren't playing. But I concede that this season has been a very interesting beginning. Lots of offense, lots of big plays, tons of stories, lots of controversy. Mm-hmm. And so we have recruited a guy I hope will wind up being a regular with us. Pat Leonard of the New York Daily News will join us. He covers the National Football League and specifically the more the Giants than the Jets, I guess, huh?
Yeah. The football Giants, as they call them.
Yeah. We'll probably chat about a whole bunch of things. Stick around. If you're a football fan, an NFL fan specifically, I think you'll enjoy it. Back after these messages. It's McCowan and Shannon on the Bob McCowan podcast on Sirius XM. Pat Leonard of the New York Daily News is with us to talk about football. And let's begin with last night's game, a rather unsurprising result. The Detroit Lions are horrible with Goff, without Goff. It doesn't matter who the quarterback is because the rest of the team is just horrific. And I guess there are people who are saying today that this is a bounce back game for Green Bay, kind of puts them on the right track. Are you buying that? Or was this just a case of playing a terrible football team?
I think you hit it right on the head, Bob. I think the opponent helped out the Packers. I don't think they cured their ills. You know, without Za'Darius Smith on the defensive line right now, out due to injury, the Packers defense is an issue. It's a problem. You know, Aaron Jones, of course, really helped them out, committing to the run game and to the running back there. I do think Aaron Rodgers is listening to the noise too much. You know, he couldn't help himself after the game, taking shots, I think, at Bill Cowher and some of the guys over at CBS who said, show me that you care more. You know, I think the more that Rodgers focuses on the field, the better off the Packers will be. I don't think this cured all their ills, but they desperately needed it. So it's a good thing they got the W.
Well, it raises a question for me, speaking of the Rodgers situation. And I think you've alluded to this. There is a sense right now that it's more about Aaron Rodgers right now than it is about winning for the Green Bay Packers. I mean, he doesn't want to be there. He would like to not be there right now, but presumably will be gone at the end of this season. If you're a teammate of Aaron Rodgers, you respect him to the nth as a player, but are you concerned about that drive, that camaraderie that you need in football in order to be successful?
I definitely think so. And even, like you said, even if you're a teammate who believes wholeheartedly in Rodgers as a player and a teammate, the tone that it sets when the clear leader of your team and organization articulates publicly prior to the season that he could be fine without football and he'd do fine if he wasn't in the NFL. If you're his teammate and that's who you're following supposedly towards a hopeful Super Bowl, there's always something in the back of your mind. I mean, I've talked to people in the NFL and, you know, I'm not reporting this, but I'm just saying there are people in the NFL who would not be surprised. Like if in week four, if this season started unraveling and Aaron Rodgers just said, I'm retiring, like nobody would be surprised. And I don't think he's going to do that, but it's to the point where if you and I feel that way, then certainly the guy a few lockers down from him has to have at least a question in the back of his mind of, where's this going? You know, how much is this going to become about him and how much can we count on him? You know, it becomes so hard too, because he's so good and talented that on a team like this, it becomes uber fragile when a guy who's the reigning MVP, it's like on a hair trigger of what's going to happen next.
Well, let's face it. He didn't get the Jeopardy job, so he doesn't have an alternative. But I don't think he needs to work, John. But he loves the limelight, Bob. You know that.
The question, Pat, is
how good is Aaron Rodgers still?
Oh, I think he still has it physically. I do think that the rust, you know, it's a cliche of guys coming back first few games. They say, oh, there's a little bit of rust I have to shake off. But I think in particular for a guy who wasn't on the football field with the Packers all offseason, it's a very real thing for him. So I think the player we see of Aaron Rodgers in, say, week 5, 6, 7 is going to tell us who he is at this point. I mean, I definitely think we saw against the Lions there in a game, really the Packers had to have. And it starts with the Lions going right down the field and scoring and taking a 7-0 lead. So I think you have to feel encouraged if you're a Packers fan that Rodgers still has it in the way he responded. But certainly it's a question of, as this season goes, will his body hold up? Will his mind hold up to the pressure in the situation he's under, no doubt?
I also have, when you look at quarterbacks of a certain age, and Rodgers is of that certain age, I wonder if they look at all at Brady and see the success that he's had. And in their mind, they say, you know, I probably should be retired, or I should think about retiring right now. But if Brady can play into his mid-40s, and that's where he is, maybe I can. Do you think Rodgers looks at that with any envy?
Yes, and I don't think he's the only one. I think Russell Wilson was doing it this offseason too. You know, there was that now famous, I guess, shot of Wilson sitting in the box at the Super Bowl with a scowl on his face. You could almost see it on his in his eyes. Wait a second. Tom Brady just basically basically single-handedly got himself traded to a team that now perfectly sets him up for a 7th Super Bowl. I could do that. And I'm good enough to do that. And a lot of quarterbacks this offseason, even Deshaun Watson prior to all the legal issues, he was another quarterback who was trying to steer his way out of town to a preferred destination. And I certainly think Rodgers, being of that certain age, that made him the most, you know, like Tom Brady in where he is in his career. And if he doesn't like his ideal situation, it's not where he's playing. Can he force his way somewhere else? And I definitely think, and I know from talking to people around the league, that that was something that these quarterbacks were looking at and saying, maybe I can pull that off too.
Well, how we talk about the envy for Brady. How much envy would Aaron Rodgers have from a guy from the NFC North and Matt Stafford getting to LA?
No doubt. No doubt. In fact, Rodgers to LA would have probably happened if at that moment the Packers weren't as reluctant and, you know, foot in the ground saying, we're not talking, we're not dealing. Like, the Rams did check on Aaron Rodgers there. And, you know, if you asked him where he'd prefer to play, it would be California. And so the Rams would have been the destination. But at that moment, it had not gone as nuclear yet. So the Packers weren't entertaining that as much. Otherwise, we'd be having a very different conversation.
Well, and the notion that of quarterbacks of some stature being traded late in their careers, late in their playing lives, to try and win is not really that rare. John and I were talking before you jumped in here about Manning and the brothers and their performance on ESPN. But Manning was a guy who was traded late in his career, moved late in his career to have some success. It's not exactly rare.
Right. What's rare is just how well it has turned out for Brady so quickly, right? Mm-hmm, sure. You know, that's
immediately, rare. Not even quickly, right?
Right. And that is the most alarming part of this. But also, to your point, Bob, that's why even though these quarterbacks might have the envy of it, the reality is that even possible to replicate? And the answer is, we look at what Brady's doing now, and the answer has to be no.
So you mentioned a name that I think a lot of people have forgotten, maybe not in Houston, but Deshaun Watson. And injuries are starting to rack up. They got problems in Indy now with Carson Wentz. They got problems in Miami now with Tua. How quickly will Deshaun Watson be back in this league?
That's a fascinating question, John. You know, I think now more than ever, there has been impetus on all sides to, like, of course, where we stand now is that this case looks like it's not going to be adjudicated, resolved, officially resolved one way or another until after the season. So the only way he could be legally cleared, or that could be, that could change, is if there were a settlement. Now, we don't know if that's going to come, when that's going to come. But to your point, he wants to play in Miami. He has a no trade clause. That's where he wants to play. The Dolphins have the draft capital and the picks to do it. They had the need before Tua got hurt. Now they definitely have the need. So would they risk making a trade for a guy and putting him on the field when the NFL hasn't disciplined him, but the NFL could discipline him any day? Is that worth the risk for the Dolphins to do? Is that worth the risk for a team like the Indianapolis Colts to do? You know, there's so many balls in the air. It's hard to tell right now whether the NFL is hanging the Houston Texans out to dry by not suspending him, or whether the NFL and Houston are both acting together and kind of collaborating to make sure he's not on the field, but also not discipline him for something that hasn't gone to trial yet, which, by the way, is not a requirement. But that's a long way of answering, John, and this is something I was talking to somebody about this morning before I came on. That's a long way of saying these teams have to do their own homework and figure out the risk reward of it. But certainly, I think sooner or later, Deshaun Watson's going to be a Dolphin. I just don't know how soon it's going to happen.
How do you feel about that? Because you mentioned this notion, and it is a fascinating conversation, I think, of whether professional sports franchises should or shouldn't discipline or be permitted to discipline an athlete when something societally that they have done is going to be adjudicated in a court of law, or at least in some other forum extraneous of the football field, baseball field, whatever it happens to be. Do you have an opinion on that? Whether, I mean, I know they have the right to do it within their constitutions, within their bylaws, but should they have that right?
Well, I think that it is case by case, but I do think, like, in a case like Deshaun Watson's, where the allegations of sexual misconduct and assault are so egregious, certainly there are two sides to every story. However, I find it difficult to believe that after this amount of time, the Texans wouldn't have enough evidence to suspend him or discipline him without having it go to a court of law. Usually in the NFL, these teams actually use the league as kind of a buffer to do the disciplining for them. So the Giants, for example, with Josh Brown, they did nothing. They were playing him in the preseason finale, even after the NFL suspended him for a game. And then they keep employing him. And then everything else comes out about the domestic violence and the Giants act. And it actually turns out they knew something beforehand. So did you need that to go to a court of law, or did you have enough evidence just to act on your own and do the right thing? I think the NFL has a troubling habit recently of dragging its feet and leaning on the legal process and the lack of its conclusion as kind of an excuse for not acting. But I think that the teams and the league should find a way and be able to and have the right to act of their own accord and just take a stand for what's right. But certainly every situation is different. And I'm talking more about Watson here than everyone.
Not taking sides, but there's a difference between the court of public opinion and the rights of an individual to be innocent until proven guilty. And so there, it's quite a dilemma, don't you think?
No, it is a dilemma, John. And that's why I certainly think that, you know, when something like that gets first reported and then accusations and allegations start flooding in, of course, at that point, it's too early to judge what happened, what didn't. I do think, however, that in this particular case, given how much time has passed and how much information has been acquired by the Texans, by the NFL, by the police, it just strains credibility for me that they don't have enough to make a decision one way or another. And I think when it gets to this point, it's almost like a statute of limitations where I feel like the clock is running out. And now you're just using as an excuse the idea that it hasn't gone to court rather than making a decision for yourself. And certainly there was an interesting piece in Sports Illustrated by Jenny Vrentis, who's doing done a great job covering this. And that there were allegations from some of the alleged victims that the NFL was asking some questionable questions about what were you wearing when you went in for this massage. And they felt like they were victim shaming and victim blaming. So especially when you start hearing that, and it starts to feel like maybe the alleged victims are catching more heat than the person who the allegations have been made against, you're right. It is a super gray area, and you don't want to rush to judgment But I do think in this situation, we haven't seen any evidence to the contrary yet, but we'll see.
The National Football League historically, now not so much recently, I can't think of too many incidents, but historically has taken the position of, if you can play football, we really don't care what you did societally, whether you are a bad person, what you did during college or are alleged to have done during school. I mean, there have been all kinds of guys who have been drafted who you raise your eyebrows and go, really? They're going right. to take him? All the evidence suggests this is a bad guy and this is high risk. Now, he happens to be a great football player. And in most of those cases, the player winds up either getting in trouble again or isn't as good a football player as they thought he was. The dilemma, I guess, at least in part here, is the National Football League separate from society in its willingness to adjudicate before adjudication, if you know what I mean? And the primary, the only example that pops in my mind, I know it's a terrible one, but imagine if O.J. Simpson had done what he did, we all are quite convinced, while he was during his playing career. Mm-hmm. And the National Football League, and I think we all believed he did it, and we believed it after the car chase, long before the trial, et cetera, et cetera. But he was acquitted.
Right.
How does that impact on the decision-making process? And does the National Football League take that into account when it's making these decisions? And maybe are they doing it with the Watson case?
Right. Yeah. You know, I think different teams have different lines they draw in the sand of what they were willing to tolerate and not on from a moral standpoint. I think a team like the Kansas City Chiefs, they let a lot go. You know, Tyreek Hill, I mean, he made the deciding catch in the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. And you could easily argue that given his history of domestic violence and abuse that he shouldn't even be in the league, let alone in the field in that game. And if I were a Chiefs beat writer, I would have been writing about that every day. Just like I hold the Giants accountable. You have Kareem Hunt who got a second chance after shoving and kicking a woman. You have Joe Mixon who got drafted by the Cincinnati Bengals despite slugging a woman. I think it was in a McDonald's in college. Just brutal stuff. And to, you know, what I'm bringing up some of these cases too is the scary part to me is some of these issues or players' behavior is a gray area. It's an allegation. It's something that it's a he said, she said. Sometimes, though, it's on video. It's there for everybody to see. There's no question of what happened. And the teams are simply looking the other way anyway because they feel like the player can help them win a game. So the sad reality is that it's about the bottom line. I'm not saying nobody deserves a second chance either. You know, I'm certainly not the person who can decide that. But I do think that I think it's healthy to hold the NFL teams and franchises, even knowing the reality of how a lot of them are operating, to a higher standard than, well, if it helps them win, it's fine. Right. And, you know, I do think that when time passes and games get played and the years go by, I do think people easily or quickly forget. Mm-hmm. If a player, let's say, is not a repeat offender of what he did prior to coming into the NFL, or if he does keep a clean sheet as he enters the league. But I do think it's important. I would say this. It's important to contextualize all of these acquisitions and the history of these teams and how they are operating. I do think it's fair to categorize them and say rank them, so to speak, on you know, how much accountability they take for people's behavior off the field and how much they look the other way and let somebody else deal with it. I do think that's a fair way to contextualize it, even if I'm not being judge and jury on it.
Do you think the fans care if their team, and it disappears only if they win? I mean, if the guy can help them win, does the fan forget?
Yes, I think so. And you know, even in the Tyreek Hill situation, I mean, I was mortified at how few people who covered the Chiefs, frankly, were talking about that when he became such a a key figure in that Super Bowl. Like, I thought the story wasn't just that he had won the game. It was, you know, wow, the Chiefs like let this guy back in the league and he won the Super Bowl. Should they have? You know, I thought that, you know, I think the media is guilty of it too, to an extent. Not all the media, but I do think a lot of it. I do think a lot of it gets wiped away. I also find, John, that I don't know where the line is. Like, I feel like it's arbitrary from fans too about what they judge as acceptable and not. You know, Kadarius Toney on the Giants now, he's a first round pick out of Florida. It was an interesting situation because last year, coming off the DeAndre Baker fiasco and armed robbery and the Giants cutting their former first round pick and all of that, who's on the Chiefs, by the way. But then they draft Kadarius Toney, who has some gun issues in his past. Mm-hmm. And before judging him, I dug into his past. I talked to people who knew him. I talked to people back in Florida. I did a lot of reporting on it. And it turned out that even though there were some question marks, he had a gun in the back of his car at one point in Florida because he and his friend were afraid of locals in the area. There was one time where he had like a plastic or, you know, gun in his hand to chase guys away. And, you know, it doesn't sound good. You'd obviously rather those things not happen. But when you do the full story and reporting on it, you discover that this young man is not who those quick sentences that I just read out to you would portray him to be, that there's a story behind it, that the Giants figured out what the story was behind it, that they believe in his high character, that that is his history, is as a high character guy. Now, he certainly had a tough start to the NFL, but I guess that's a long-winded way of me making the point that it's not always what it looks like or seems like. So I do think it's important as a journalist and as a reporter to really try and flush out the full story on these types of situations. And I think what I try to do is not judge, but give you all the information to make your own decision. And I bring up that I don't know where people stand, because I think there's some people who they read that story and they still think Tony's a bad egg. And then there's other people who read that and say, good for him. He deserves a second chance. You know, I don't like hearing that he has red flags. That's not fair to him. So it all does seem to be in the eye of the beholder sometimes.
Well, yeah, I think there are two things that occur to me, and I have no evidence to support this notion, but the 53rd man on the roster is not going to be treated the same as a top five guy on a roster when it comes even to issues like this. And secondly, if you're a fan of a team who has a problematic player on it, who has some alleged or factual indiscretion that's being noticed, you're going to be much more forgiving. If he's playing for your rival team, you want him out, and you're yelling and screaming, why is this guy still playing? And those, right. That's human nature. And I don't know. I don't think any of us can pretend to understand how you fix that. That's just the way it is, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's certainly Roger Goodell came in when he came into the league as commissioner. I mean, this is one of his points of emphasis to kind of restore order to the league. And of course, we had the whole Ray Rice fiasco, however, of saying it was one thing and then video evidence showing us that it was another. And so you see now with the Watson situation and with some of these other situations that there doesn't seem to be, and this is not just me talking, this is from people around the league, you know, teams, players, there doesn't seem to be consistency always in how these situations are dealt with. So it is hard to always look at each one and say, here's where that stands and what should happen, or also even to predict how the league is going to act. So I think the bottom line is a lot of coaches look at it like, I'm not, you know, they all have different things they're willing to tolerate and not. But when big issues like this happen, they do their best to do their own research, but they also expect to be told if the league has more information that they don't have yet, that you need, this guy can't be on the field because of X, Y, and Z. So there needs to be some communication and coordination between the league and the teams in order to try to do the right thing. You're not always going to succeed, but to try to do the right thing.
Do you believe the National Football League had a practice, a policy of covering up PED use?
Oh, wow. Do I believe that they have a policy of covering it up? I don't think that they try to cover that up. I do think that players will always try to push the limit of what is allowed or what can fit into whatever the collectively bargained policy is. I also think that some players, I always get blown away when these guys nowadays get suspended for 6 games or 4 games because it's almost like you're going to get tested for it. You know, you're getting tested for it. And there's a defined list that if you emailed the NFLPA and said, can I have this list of banned substances? It'd be back in your inbox in 5 minutes.
Yep.
So no, I mean, are there guys who have used steroids through the years who have never been reported that they used it, have never been caught? I would say that's probably true, but I don't have direct evidence to support that, and I don't have direct evidence of any cover-up either.
No, and I don't imply that I have, by no means. I know this is sort of a dated subject, but you know, PED use has become a non-issue in sports today, but certainly in the National Football League. But you go back 10 years, or however long, when Major League Baseball, suddenly discovered that a significant portion of their players were taking PEDs when they were in complete denial that this was a problem.
Right.
That explosion of information and the way it changed the way baseball had to deal with PEDs. You then look at a sport far more physical in the National Football League, where size, speed, it became obvious to anybody that if you were going to succeed in the NFL in an era where PEDs were being used by everybody, this is where the biggest problem was. There was almost no reaction from the NFL. There was not an explosion of positive tests. It just seemed to me that was inconsistent with reality.
I don't think you're the anecdotal evidence there that you're gathering is off as far as like, wait a minute, how could this not be happening in football if it's happening in baseball? And I would tell you this too. Sometimes guys sustain injuries that make people raise their eyebrows, like torn pectoral muscles and, things that there are just certain types of consistent injuries that maybe guys who are doing or straining their body might happen more than guys who are not. So there's certainly eyebrow raising. I know, like when Adrian Peterson came back off that ACL and ran for 2,000 yards, I know, it makes you raise your eyebrows. Like, wait a minute.
Oh, yeah.
How could you possibly do that? J.J. Watt was in college was a guy who no one was scared of. And then he turned into, Superman and like a Marvel super comic hero. Even now, and I'm not telling you these guys are on steroids, but I'm just saying, you look at Tom Brady now, and his doctor who has worked on TB12 with him is Alex Guerrero.
Yeah.
And Brady always talks about pliability. He's definitely seems to look and feel healthier down in the Florida sun. And he has dedicated pretty much his life now to taking care of his body, and good for him. But I do think somebody will look into and write the story of if he continues to play, if he plays till his 50, Alex Guerrero was, in hot water for things connected to Alex Rodriguez for questionable practices. And so those types of questions, especially when a guy succeeds at an age or at something physically that people have never done before, I certainly think that those are questions that will get raised, by people who cover the league. Simply because anything unprecedented warrants further,
I don't think it's unrealistic to be simultaneously respectful and suspicious.
Totally agree, Bob. Totally agree.
Let's take a quick break. I want to talk. I got a few other things to talk about, and I'm sure John does too.
Can we talk football?
Yeah, we'll do that. Well, we sort of were. Pat Leonard is with us from the New York Daily News. We'll be back after these messages. Bob McCallum, John Shannon, Pat Leonard of the Daily News of New York is with us. Here's something that's driven me crazy for some time. I don't understand power rankings. And so I pay little attention to them. And I know it's sort of a man-made conglomeration of opinion here. But here's the reality. Of the top six in the NFL power rankings right now, two teams are 2-0. The rest are all 1-1. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does. I don't know what six you're talking about specifically. I think I could probably guess a lot of them.
Well, I got the list. Tampa Bay is number one, and they're 2-0. Yeah. Kansas City 2, Baltimore 3, both 1-1. Rams are 4 at 2-0. Buffalo and Green Bay are 5-6 at 1-1.
Gotcha. Right. Okay. So that makes sense to me for this reason. So the Buffalo Bills, despite losing to the Steelers in week one, their total annihilation of the Dolphins seemed to kind of restore order on what people thought the Bills might be this year and whether they can finish the job. You know, that makes sense to me. I think the Rams and the Ravens, these are teams that, because of their quarterbacks or because of some advantage on their offense for the most part, that in a game, in a league where pretty much most weeks you're looking at needing to score 30 points a win to win based on how the league is now favoring offenses and how it's officiated, these are all teams who can run you off the field with their offense. You know, even we saw what the Ravens did to the Chiefs. You know, I think the difference between 1-1 and 0-2 after 2 weeks is staggering as far as your chances of the playoffs. But certainly when you have an MVP candidate on your team too, like the Ravens are 1-1, but they have Lamar Jackson, who's already won an MVP. The Bills are 1-1, but they have Josh Allen, who was an MVP candidate a year ago. You know, I think you can't underestimate the stars. Green Bay has Aaron Rodgers, who was the reigning MVP. So I think a lot of those 1-1 teams we're talking about are guys, are teams that they have built-in talent advantages at the most important position and positions in the game to overcome weaknesses. And, you know, this is something I was talking to people about this week with the Giants, who I'm covering a lot here in New Jersey, New York, is you watch Lamar Jackson throw two interceptions, including one really bad one in that game against the Chiefs. But in the NFL, just like in any sport, you know, yes, coaches have to scheme it up, but talent wins. And it's never perfect for these teams. Kyler Murray threw two interceptions this past week. He might be the leading MVP candidate for Arizona. You know, when you have talent and you have superior talent, you can overcome those mistakes. And when you're bad teams, you can't. So, you know, those teams aren't perfect that you're listing, especially those 1-1s. But I just think that their strengths, they're just able to overcome their weaknesses because they're that good.
So how bad are the Giants?
That's a good question. They are, they're not as bad as.
Because I'm gonna ask about the Jets soon too, Pat. Don't worry. I'm going to ask about the Jets.
Okay.
So how bad are the Giants first?
I got to leave a number below the Giants. Okay. I got good to know. Well, the funny thing, John, is that, and you know this from watching, but everybody thought, not, I didn't think the defense was going to be like a top five, but you thought that if the Giants were losing games, it would be because of their offense primarily. But so far, it's been the opposite. Their defense has been horrific. And their offense, you know, the offensive line is still in shambles and is a week-to-week project. Daniel Jones's week one turnover was big, and certainly some of their play calling deserves, you know, warrants skepticism. But their defense, if they don't get their defense figured out, their offense is not a 30-point-per-game offense like we were just discussing. That can overcome it. And so can the Giants get it figured out? They did last year with some game planning on the defensive side. But unless they restore some order there, they're just not going to win many games. I put it this way. I predicted them to go 7-10. And right now they don't look like a team that's going to win seven games.
And what about the other team? What about the Jets?
Oh, boy. You know, I watched the beginning of that New England game, and I actually thought Robert Saleh, the head coach, had the Jets ready to play, and they looked ready to compete in and win possibly that game. Not only did they fall apart, though, but to me, the worst part of this is, and now I'm not writing Zach Wilson off as a bad quarterback or anything, but his four interceptions, I mean, most of these throws, it wasn't like New England made incredible plays to jump a pass. He threw the ball right to them for the most part. And so that was my big concern there. You know, they sat Jamison Crowder, who's a really good veteran receiver. They sat Denzel Mims, who's a big body deep threat, second year guy. He's been out of favor. Obviously, they're down Mekhi Becton, their left tackle. They lost Carl Lawson for the season on the pass rush. And if Wilson's playing like this, the Jets fans booing in their first home game with Zach Wilson playing, let's just put it that way, that is a bad sign. And unless he curbs the turnovers, they're looking at challenging for the number one, two, three pick again.
And particularly when Sam Darnold's in Carolina and looks so good, and they're 2-0, right?
There's no question, John. And that's why, you know, quarterback wins are a fair stat and then aren't at the same time. You know, I think Darnold in Carolina early on now is proof that it's not all the quarterback. There are things you can build around him. There are things you can teach him. There are things that you can help him with, running game, strong defense, to help him win some games. And I certainly did not believe Darnold was a lost cause. I can see the talent in Wilson that prompted the Jets to move on from Darnold and draft him. But I did not think Darnold was such a lost cause that it was time to rip the Band-Aid off and you absolutely needed to change QBs. You're right, though. Losing, not only being 0-2, but losing head-to-head to Darnold, it's kind of some little more salt in the wound, right?
Well, the Darnold suggestion, I mean, I agree with you 100%. I think Goff is a similar suggestion, but on the other side, you know, I think Goff's a pretty good quarterback, but he's surrounded by nobody. And, you know, can't win. He can't win with that team. Quarterback is the most important position. I think we all know that. But you've got to have a little bit around you in order for that quarterback to be truly impactful and change games. Yes?
Yes. And, you know, you hit on with Goff is he's in a situation where, I mean, it's better that he's there than in LA where they didn't want him anymore. But,
well, granted.
But he's also on a team where, to your point, they're rebuilding and everybody knows and they've said openly that this is about the future and not the present. So he's kind of, you know, the deck stack against him, so to speak. And I actually, you know, I tweeted last night watching that first half. He made some really nice throws.
Pretty good in the first half.
Yeah, like that second touchdown pass he threw to Hockenson in the back of the end zone. I mean, that was a perfect throw. And he had about four or five of them. And I was going, wow, you know, you see the number one pick in him. But yeah, that's just not a team where you're going to win games. So that'll be mentally straining on him for sure. It would be interesting, because he's still young, it would be interesting to see him. You know, I know there was speculation even after the Lions acquired him, if they would flip him somewhere else because they were so focused on going and getting more draft picks. And, you know, you have to enter his name into the conversation at the trade deadline, possibly, right? For some of these
other teams. Oh, sure, I would.
Yeah.
You got, if your quarterback goes down with an injury, especially, you're going to look at that, right? I don't know whether it's
Washington, you know.
Yep. Yeah. Well, speaking of quarterbacks, John wanted to talk a little bit about Kyler Murray. I'll let you ask the question, John.
Well, yeah, just, sure. I mean, this guy has, I mean, when you look at that division, as strong as it is, and you got Russell Wilson, who's 5'10", and Murray's 5'8" on a good day, they've redefined the way the quarterback plays the position. But Murray's instincts, I think, are probably the best in the National Football League. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I would. And also, John, he's not the same player as Lamar Jackson, but in the same way as Lamar, he does things in the moment in games that are, it's improv. It's at high speed that guys aren't used at a speed that guys aren't used to facing. And it's unpredictable. He never does the same thing twice. And he had three throws and plays, you know, on the run, moving, you know, throwing down the field plays in that week one win over Tennessee that were arguably better than any other play that anyone had made all week. And then against that zero blitz against Minnesota last week, mm-hmm. he does that, backs up, throws off his back foot, kind of just flicks it up in the air for Christian Kirk. And, you know, it was always amazing to me that Steve Keim, the general manager there, was afforded the opportunity to draft a second QB after the Josh Rosen pick. Because you just don't see that in the NFL. You don't see mulligans. But certainly you can see the reason why Cliff Kingsbury was so bullish on Kyler. And it's actually funny. Coming into this season, coming off of last year, a lot of their offense was horizontal. It was, you know, read option, get the ball out to the sideline. And even when he was, you know, keeping the ball, a lot of it was being steered to the sidelines and there just wasn't enough big play ability in it for me. And I'm looking at defenses, how they were defending them last year and saying, I think they understand how to keep the lid on this offense. And obviously I was dead wrong because these last 2 weeks, they have just exploded. Now, granted, this is two defenses that struggle. So I don't think they'll be at, you know, go as buck wild against some of these other teams that they face in their division, especially, you know, the Rams, the Niners. But I mean, John, let's be honest. I mean, if anybody's an MVP front runner or candidate, it's him right now.
Well, and the truth I think you would acknowledge is that with a young quarterback, you try and keep things simple. You're going to be more horizontal than vertical. And there comes a point where you say, okay, we're going to take the lid off here and throw the ball downfield a little bit more. A lot easier to throw 3 and 4 yard passes and hope something happens than throw 20 and 30 yard passes and hope something bad doesn't happen.
Yeah, remember he was hurt. He was hurt in the second half of last season. You know, this we did see examples of this as the season started last year, because he was just phenomenal. I mean, a couple of games against Seattle, he was unbelievable. But a lot of credit has to go to Kingsbury. I mean, he's done a very good job in Arizona for what they have to work with. Now they have to learn how to stop the other team from scoring, because that's going to be the biggest key, is when the defense works.
Yes, definitely. You're not always going to have Chandler Jones going off for 5 or 6 sacks. They have to figure out the defense. But yeah, no, you hit on a good point too, is some of these games, like last year too, even before he got hurt, like when the Giants played him, some of the other teams play him, Kingsbury will run the ball with Chase Edmonds. And if you don't stop the run, then Kyler will never throw the ball, you know, down the field all day, because he doesn't have to. Mm-hmm. And to your point, he's so fast, getting 4 or 5 yards a chunk on a quarterback keeper going to the sideline is fine. It's keeping your defense on the field, and it's not putting him in harm's way and keeping him in the pocket.
Before we let you go, we all know that everybody has their own favorite NFL team, but if there's a commonality of teams that you hate, I would say the Raiders would be at or near the top of the list for most people. If you don't love the Raiders, you probably hate the Raiders. And there's been plenty of history to suggest why that should be the case. But these Raiders are 2-0. Is this a mirage, or is there something good going on in Las Vegas?
Well, based on their coaching malfunctions and turnovers and the things that happened at the end of that Ravens game, you know, being 2-0 almost isn't 2-0 is almost an asterisk after how messy the end of that game was. But you make a good point on the fact that they have an NFL defense now. I mean, John Gruden, what is this, year 4? And
is it already? Wow.
I think it's year 4. And their defense has been atrocious, putrid since he's been there. And suddenly they're competitive. They're in your face. Their pass rush is there. Max Crosby's leading the way there. And they even had their number 4 overall pick, Cleveland Farrell, inactive for their first game. And their pass rush was still doing work. You know, I think Derek Carr is not an elite quarterback, but they have a good enough offense that, and a good enough quarterback, that if their defense is competent, they could challenge for a wild card. I mean, they're in a really tough division, especially given how good Denver looks now too. But I think the Raiders have shown that they could compete on the level of a Denver. And if Kansas City's offense or defense doesn't get their stuff together, I mean, Oakland beat them last year and gave them a harder time last year than any other team, both games they played. So I'm not saying they're going all the way or anything, but certainly they look like, in a division where you can't compete really right now with the Chiefs of the world, they look competitive.
Hey, a guy who covered Eli Manning, what do you think of the Manning brothers thing on ESPN?
I think it's really good. I think I like that they have good guests and they play off each other. I think it's good for the world to see the funny of Eli Manning, because he's so dry. He almost surprised, even if you know he's funny, he surprises you every time he is because of his demeanor. Peyton's a little bit of a nerd, right? A football nerd, but it's a good nerdy, because you can see it through the eyes of the quarterback at all times. I think it's fantastic. I don't like, frankly, what it does to the guys who are under contract doing the main broadcast. You know, like if I'm Greasy or Steve Levy or Lewis Riddick, I'm feeling like, oh, yeah, it's great you guys are doing this, but you're taking viewers away from me. This is my time to shine. But I do think it's a fantastic watch.
I wonder if it's sustainable. That's what we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
That's the key, is can they keep doing this? I mean, Peyton did a thing last night in the third quarter talking about how Aaron Rodgers can throw the ball. He stood up and he talked about he can throw it across his body. He can throw it from the back foot. He can throw it anytime, anywhere. And it was just, it was brilliant, brilliant stuff that you could never get on a regular broadcast. But will we grow tired of it? That to me is the biggest question. Peyton's a great entertainer. Eli's the dry comedy, but you wonder if they can sustain it.
Yeah, no, that's true. I do think that even though no one can be the Manning brothers, you know, the football royalty, I do think every analyst, especially the former players, can learn and could replicate the element of don't be afraid to, like, tell us what happened when you were a player. I think a lot of former players, they become these analysts and then they won't give you the inside football or the inside baseball. It's like, no, you know, you need to be like Aqib Talib is good. Like, tell me if this guy was a problem in the locker room, or tell me about that story where you cost your team the game because you forgot to play, or tell me that this guy was really hurt in this game where he threw 5 touchdowns and no interceptions. If you're just going to sit there and comment on that was a good throw, this and that, well, no, you can't replicate that because that's not what the Manning brothers are doing. Eli or Peyton saying that the New England Patriots were bugging his locker room on the road in Foxborough. If you give me that, then you can replicate something that is different than what other people can tell you. But if you're just sitting there with saying platitudes, then no way can you deliver the kind of knowledge and insight that these guys have brought to it so far.
And that's what we all want. We got to get out of here. Time is our enemy. Pat, it was really enjoyable. Great to meet you. And hopefully we'll have a chance to do this again in the not too distant future. Thanks so much for being with us.
I would love that, Bob and John. Thank you so much for having me.
Pat Leonard of the New York Daily News. John and I will come back after these messages. So we always thank the guest, but I enjoyed that. That was fun. Pat's got a lot of opinions. It's not all out of the NFL box. So we're hopeful that he'll join us again, Pat Leonard.
And for a guy who does cover the Giants a great deal, there's a lot more knowledge about the 32 teams of the league rather than just one.
Sure.
That's nice to see.
We only got a couple of minutes here. So let me throw this at you. You've got an MVP vote. Mm-hmm. Otani or Guerrero?
It's funny. 3 weeks ago, I was going 100% Otani. I would have been on the Otani bandwagon, seeing what Guerrero has done recently, the fact that the Jays are actually in a playoff race, I'm changing my vote, and I'm going for the Guerrero now. I really am.
Well, it's interesting that you offered that perspective, because I have had this opinion for a long period of time, and I'm sure I've enunciated it. The notion of, they call it the MVP. They don't call it the best player. They call it the most valuable player. Mm-hmm. And if you subscribe to a dictionary's definition of MVP, don't you have to be on a competitive team? Don't you have to be the best player on a that has helped to make a team good enough to be relevant? And as good as Otani is, as good as Trout has been, and I'm going to argue, I mean, he's been out all year, but Trout's the best player in baseball. But I'm not going to vote for him for MVP because the team has to be able to do something. His performance has to impact the team in a positive way. And Guerrero has now accomplished that since the Toronto Blue Jays have gone on this run and now become a playoff contender.
Well, and I mean, the one thing that people were wondering when there was a bit of that swoon with the Jays, and it did coincide with a bit of a swoon for Guerrero, he's come back and been tremendous and has been really a big part of the impetus, in addition to the starting pitching and the bullpen, for this team to get back into that wild card race. I've always believed in these team sports. Now, baseball is the least team sport of the big four. I've always believed that being and getting to the postseason has to be an important part of being the most valuable player in any league. I really believe that.
Well, that's my whole point, John.
Yeah,
I'm with you. Connor McDavid has been the best player in the National Hockey League for several years, without question. But I'm not voting for him for MVP if his team doesn't make the playoffs at least.
Well, in fact, In fact, 2 years ago, I had a vote 2 years ago, and McDavid was not number one on my ballot because the Oilers did not make the playoffs. And I think that that has to be a key part of what goes on in any of the sports about a team specific most valuable player.
Even if you're not a golf fan, we maybe might will be interested in tomorrow's show. It's Ryder Cup time, and Ryder Cup is just one of those events where even if you don't watch any golf during the year, you might watch golf this weekend. It'll depend, I think, a great deal on whether it's competitive, but it has that certain cachet. It's not as big as a major, in my opinion, but it's certainly bigger than, the FedEx Cup, with no disrespect intended. Mm-hmm. And it's become intriguing the last few years because it actually is competitive. You're not 100% sure the U.S. is going to destroy Europe.
Oh, no. Well, I tell you what, weather's going to be a factor at Whistling Straits. The fact that these individual entrepreneurs, golfers, become part of a team changes the whole dynamic. And what's most exciting about it.
We're going to talk about it tomorrow. Hope you'll join us for it. For John Shannon and Bob McCowan.